We also have our question time, and the question time today. Dear Bhante, how is gentleness and kindness practiced in daily life? It's easy. Just be gentle and be kind. Be gentle to your husband, be kind to your wife, and especially be gentle and kind to your favourite monks and nuns. Especially sometimes you're fed up and grumpy. You don't feel like being kind and gentle to others. You just want everyone to go away. But you're expected to be kind and nice. Keeping the precepts is not hard. Be kind always is the hard part. No, it's actually harder to be unkind. It's much more difficult being unkind because if you're unkind to someone, that people scowl back at you. And that's really ugly. To see people getting angry back at you. But if you're kind to others, they smile back at you. And life is much more beautiful when you see smiley people. Try and see. And also, if you're unkind to other people, you're not gentle, then you get all this karma afterwards. People are just upset at you and they don't help you. You need somebody's assistance. I'm not going to help her. Why should I help her? She never helped me. She said the unkind things about me. Why should I do anything for him? But if you're gentle and kind, yeah, it may take a little bit more effort, but it's an investment for your future. You always have to say in Western situations, investments and great returns. So you're investing for your future. And anyway, just we're talking about in the Australian Sangha Association, about all these monks and nuns who are getting very old. We have to sort of build retirement homes for monks and nuns. You interested over there? And if you're not kind to all these lay people, they won't build you a nice home to retire. They won't look after you. They always say that. It was a saying on the back of a car in Perth. Be kind to your children, because they're going to choose your retirement home. So if you're really kind and gentle to people, they will look after you. If you don't, you're in big trouble. So it's actually, if you look at the consequences of unkindness in your daily life, it's just not worth it. So, you know, in the long term, you just lose everything. So be kind and be gentle to everybody. And then that's your investment, your superannuation, as they say in Australia, in karma for the future. Next question. Some meditators go cuckoo. How could that possibly happen? It's because they were cuckoo to begin with. So we just uncovered the sort of stupidity and madness which was in them all the time. Not our fault. We don't take any responsibility. Don't try and sue us. You should have seen the disclaimer in the registration form. Anyone who goes cuckoo, you have to look after yourself. Actually, just in the back room over there, we've got the straitjacket in the cupboard. Did Bianca show you where the straitjacket was, in case of, no, we haven't got a straitjacket for this monastery. No, but really, seriously, that sometimes people do go cuckoo if they struggle too hard. That's really where you sort of you create some problems. And so you have seen people in retreats who just really force themselves. They're going to sit through pain. They're going to beat down their mind. And that sort of aggressive attitude, yeah, that can send you a little bit crazy. But this sort of gentle, kind, peaceful method, it's just, this is the safest type of meditation there is. And anyway, you've got more likelihood of going cuckoo when you don't meditate. And why do you say going cuckoo? You know why they call it going cuckoo? Because the cuckoo keeps beating its head against the tree. Have you been beating your head against the tree in this meditation retreat? Trying to get jhana, trying to get, just even trying to be in the present moment, beating your head against, bang, 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 bang. That's gone cuckoo. So stop trying that. Stop beating your head against a brick wall. You know, there's actually a door through that wall. You know, you just open the door rather than beating your head. And what's that door? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. By the end of this retreat, you know, next time you hear be kind, be peaceful, be gentle, that's going to really send you cuckoo. There was a time when I thought the only type of people who shouldn't meditate are those with schizophrenia. But I've found now that sometimes people can do it. Just their attitude. Because before I was really scared, because schizophrenia, especially if you hear voices and see stuff and you really believe in it, that can send you crazy. But in the end, it's just, again, just how you relate to those sounds and visions which are going on in your head. And with wisdom, you can even meditate. You've got to be very careful. Meditate as a schizophrenic. So I've seen that happen, and people do a wonderful job. And again, it's the attitude which you have to your meditation. That gentleness, that kindness. You don't get sucked into those visions, no more than you guys and girls get sucked into the thoughts which, you know, take you off. It's just thought, that's all. It's just a sound. It's just someone telling me to kill everyone in this meditation retreat center. So you don't take it seriously. You get some sort of sense of letting go, just making peace, being kind to it. Oh, it just comes, it goes. And that degree of attitude, you can see, not only does it work really well with people who have that disease, but it also works very well with you. You don't get caught up in things. So you have this beautiful sense of just being peaceful with whatever happens. Oh, just another crazy thought. Oh, just another sleepy episode. Oh, just another bit of restlessness. Oh, just another jhana. So whatever happened, you just, this is life. With that type of attitude, that's how we meditate. And people who understand that, they never go crazy. This craziness just can't take hold of them. Number three, how do one recognize an enlightened being? Look in a mirror. That's a good one, isn't it? Because in that sense, which I've said before, the jhanas is right in this crazy moment. One day, maybe during this retreat, I'll give that old simile of the thousand petal lotus. The innermost petal is right in the center of the outermost one. And the outermost petal of lotus, you go and see any old lotus in a park. The outer one is dirty, it's hard, there's no fragrance to it at all. It's the most useless, unattractive petal you can possibly hope to see, because it has to take all the wind and the sun and the dust and everything. It's the innermost ones that are really beautiful. But the innermost one is always contained within the outermost one. So it's a great symbol. In this very moment, right now, this thing which you're experiencing in this moment, right at its center is jhana. So you don't have to move. You just have to go deeper into this. You're just opening up the petals of a lotus, going into its center. You never go on to the next stage of meditation. You go into this moment, into this thing which you're experiencing now, to get to the next level. Always going in. So you get into the jhanas. And what's in the middle of the jhanas? That's where enlightenment is. So right in the center of the jhanas, just go in. And that's where you feel and see enlightenment. So you look in the mirror, see this stupid face of this idiot meditator who goes really crazy. And right in the middle of that, there's an enlightened being. And that's an interesting perception. So you don't have to change anything. You don't have to sort of suddenly have this metamorphosis. It's just right in the center of you. So you just go in. That's why we call it insight. Inside meditation. It's supposed to be a joke. You must be all asleep. Oh, it's a terrible joke. But always going in, never going on. And then you understand how you recognize an enlightened being. But who do you expect an enlightened being is? Would you know one if you saw one? Probably not. Because sometimes that we used to joke, maybe like a person with a lobotomy who's brain dead, people might sort of confuse between an enlightened being. Just sit here. You say, you stupid monk, and they just sit here. And you say, oh, you're a wonderful monk, and they just sit here. What's the difference between being enlightened and brain dead? So what is enlightenment anyway? So, you know, it's people without sort of greed, hatred, and delusion. How do you know that? It's so hard to know. It takes one to know one. So you're stuffed. You can't be. So just, but you can get a feel peaceful and calm. The thing is that how can you recognize a person is not enlightened? Now that's a question you can answer. If a person gets angry and upset, they are not enlightened. If they get afraid, boo! They are not. If they see a ghost, if you turn down all the lights and I invite a ghost to come in, would you be afraid? A real ghost. Would you be terrified? You're not enlightened. So enlightened beings are not afraid because they've got nothing to lose. What matters? So no fear, no desire. So if it was a monk, you can get... Who's the most beautiful girl in the world right now? You can get her to come in here and take off all her clothes and do a lap dance on a monk. And he would just, yeah, so what? It's just five candles messing around. So I would try that to try and test one of our monks out. Please don't do that. But as you know, no lust, no sort of desire, no sort of craving. That's the sort of way you can understand a monk, an enlightened being. But you can understand they're not an enlightened being if they get angry especially. That's the easy one. Starting to understand the importance of kindness will be useful to learn to hear more. Be kind, 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 be kind. Please describe, here's enough. Please describe how liberation through metta happened. The Appamana states, is there a method of release through this way? Did Buddha describe a method for metta meditation the same way as he described breath avoidance meditation? Please describe how boundless immeasurable states can happen. Well, here we go. So, loving kindness. I mean, some of you have done love. We did the loving kindness metta sutta. You chanted it. I was listening to it outside there. So, you have that sutta. Now, what happens? Some of you will just do it like parrots. You've done it before. You just get through it. Others of you actually listen to what it says. And when you really listen and pay attention, it actually moves you to metta. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they're great or small, intelligent or stupid, gay, straight, bisexual, whoever they are, may all beings be happy and well. Even that person who really irritated and upset you today, there's always one in your cottage. May they be happy and well. And when you actually think like that, it really moves the mind. It frees it. It gives you some piti sukha, some happiness, and some stillness. So you keep on moving in that direction, developing this stillness, this piti sukha, this inspiration. And you keep on doing that until the mind gets very still. Because metta, loving kindness, is a wonderful form of letting go. Real love is accepting someone and being caring for them, wishing them well, unconditionally. It's the unconditional part which is a powerful ingredient of loving kindness. It has to be totally unconditional. Even the bastards, the people who really sort of piss you off, the ones who just, you really would know, they deserve to be thrown in a pit of biting ants. Those sorts of people, say, may they be happy and well. And it's something really beautiful and freeing in that. Number one, just half of the business of your life, revenge, anger, guilt against yourself, is totally eradicated. You feel so free and light with loving kindness. You just got no business anymore. Nothing to do. You're free. So it leads to a great state of stillness. But it's different than the breath meditation because love, that metta, also carries with it a very stronger dose of piti sukha, of happiness and joy. This is nature. So when you do get still, you get a huge amount of bliss and energy. So you do that, you do those sort of sayings, but you feel it as well. It's not just words you chant. That's why if you're ever doing any sort of mantra, you know, even the I will die, that's for sure. You don't do I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die. I will die. Pause and listen. That's for sure. Let it reverberate inside your heart. But only when the echoes stop, then say it again, I will die. Listen to its meaning. That's for sure. May I be happy and well. Pause and let those words do its work. And then you get what we call the feeling, the experience of metta. And soon that gets so strong, it becomes self-sustaining. You don't need to say, may all beings be happy and well anymore. You don't need to say, may I be happy and well. You just have it there. Metta, the experience. And when you dwell on that, it's just an easy thing to dwell on. It's just joyful. It's a lovely thing to watch. And because it's a lovely thing to watch, the metta grows and grows in intensity. And of course, you know what happens next? You get this incredible, beautiful metta nimitta. Bright, brilliant, and literally lovely. This is just what happens. The body disappears, and the metta has all gone into the mind, and gives this is metta nimitta. And those metta nimittas are just great. I mean, they're just so easy to watch, because they're already a lot of power and brilliance and joy. Just some of the most beautiful things you've ever seen with your mind's eye. So it's very easy to merge into that, and then you're in your jhanas. That's how you get the release, through metta. And the apamana part of it, pamana means like measuring. It's like not sort of a measureless attainment, it's actually, it started not measuring people. If you love things, you don't measure them. If you love your kids, you don't measure them, you know, that this kid is a good kid, that kid's a bad kid. You love them and that's it. Just because they're your kid is enough. Whether a good kid or bad kid, they're clever, they're deformed, it doesn't matter. They're my kid and I love them, that's it. So it's a love which does not measure. And because it doesn't measure, it gives this other sort of sense of non-criticizing, non-fault-finding. Just accepting without measure. And when you do that, it's very easy to get into strong jhana states. So that's how it actually works. You have a great time. But the trick is, whenever you recite something, stop and listen afterwards until you feel metta. Not the word, but the thing it's supposed to be pointing to. Just like I said, you know, before, yesterday with the cup, or this morning, whatever it was. You know, you look at a cup, blue, sort of got a lid on it this today. All those words, and you stop, and then you get like the essence of cup. You just, there, you can't put a name to it, but it's there. You get the sort of the essence of metta. And that's when you really get off into the deep, blissful states. So give it a try. Any comments on that? Good. Okay, Mike. Yeah. Very good. Another satisfied customer. So imaginations work well as long as you sort of, you know, give it the right sort of descriptions. So no beautiful door, you know, whatever beautiful door is. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, I'm using mindfulness to tackle mosquito bites at dusk. Wouldn't that be seducting the monks to the risk of malaria? If you're in Thailand, how do you use this method with training of monks? Trust in the Dhamma. Why is it some people get bitten by mosquitoes and they get malaria while some people don't? Because I was there, I got bitten many, 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 many times. I never got malaria. It's those people who think, I'm going to get malaria. I'm going to get malaria. Maybe this mosquito. It looks like the right type of mosquito. Then you get your malaria. The mind is very powerful. Actually, it says in the suttas that people who are doing better, they don't get sick, it protects them from fire and poison. That's what the Buddha said anyway. How can that happen? The power of the mind is immense. And never, ever sort of diminish that power. Or, no, in your ideas, never sort of underestimate that power, I was trying to say. So if you have loving kindness to mosquitoes, even those ones with the malaria vaccine, yeah, they inject it into your body, and the metta just saps it. Poof. And it's all gone. You have to have big metta. Yes. Yes, little mosquito over there. May you be happy and well. Yeah. Why did the Buddha die? No, it was suicide. Because he let... How could the Buddha commit suicide? Did the Buddha commit suicide? Because 3 months prior to his parinibbana, at the Chapala shrine, he deliberately gave up his life faculty, his will to live. And because he'd done everything he needed to do. He was finished. It's like knocking off on a Friday after work. He'd done his job. And the Buddha said it was, Channa committed suicide? And the Buddha said his suicide was absolutely blameless. If you're an arahat, it's no problem at all. Some arahats, they're really cool. Like Ananda, you know how he died? He was being followed by these two kingdoms because they wanted his ashes, his relics. Relics is big business, even these days, especially in those days. You get relics, you know, in your monastery. Suppose, you know, we had real sort of Buddha relics in our monastery, you know, real ones, like exhibit rays and everything. And people go on pilgrimage and tours there. You get a lot of money. So relics were really big business. So these two kingdoms, please come and die in our kingdom. No, don't die in their stupid kingdom. Come and die in our kingdom. We want your relics in our kingdom. We'll build a big stupa for you. No, we'll build a bigger stupa in our kingdom. And so they were vying for his relics. So Ananda, he was 120 years of age. So what he did, he walked to the river which separated their two kingdoms. And he rose up into the air, levitated, and went into the exact middle of the river, the boundary, rose up into the air, and he entered the fire element, self-combusted, and before he did that, he determined that the two ashes would fall on either side of the river in exactly equal piles, so both kingdoms wouldn't go to war. And so that's what happened. It was suicide. He gave up his. He gave, but there was no ill will, no craving. It was just life faculties finished. It's a very good, efficient way of just. Getting rid of your body. Very cool way of doing it. Because, you know, cremations cost a lot of money. We should do that these days. You don't have to go to all these crematoriums and stuff. Just do it on the spot. Very neat. You want to do that, sister? But interestingly, 3 months before he passed away, he gave up that will to live. So, you know, it was a deliberate act, premeditated. But he said he'd only do that because he'd made a resolution, almost like a promise, to Mara just after his enlightenment. I will not pass away until I've established the four assemblies, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasakas, upasikas, laymen and women, disciples, those four assemblies. They're well established, they're strong, so I'm not needed anymore. So that's why he said, job's done. Then he left. Brilliant.
In Vietnam, during the war,
yeah. Well, the reason why they did that, because I remember sort of seeing those photographs of them, But what wasn't really emphasized enough is the poems which they nailed to the lamppost explaining why they did this. And it was just to bring attention just to the lack of peace, the corruption in their government, who's a Catholic prime president in a majority Buddhist country, really just abusing his power. That was Diem or something, causing a huge amount of problems. And they were trying to sort of get some peace in their land. They will be manipulated by foreign governments. Not really justifiable. It was obviously it never worked. But on the opposite, after they did that there, about a year or two later, there was a young Czech man called Jan Palach who immolated himself in a square in Prague as a protest against the Soviet occupation of his country. He became a martyr, and now that square is named after him, Jan Palach Square. He did exactly the same, but because it was in the West, and the cause which the Western governments really approved of, he is now a national hero. So really, it's just how it's interpreted by us. But as far as the karma is concerned, because you know the intention was, in a sense, to help other people, but it was killing himself. It was what we call black and white karma. A mixture. So it's not to be recommended. But interestingly, there was a man called Samana Gota in Athens from India who immolated himself and caused a sensation in the forum at Athens. That's all it says. But that's really fascinating. I want to find out more about that. Samana Gota, that's Samana, that's a Buddhist monk. So it was a Buddhist monk who for some reason or another immolated himself. Now, did he actually get a pyre and just sit on top of it? Or was it one of like these stories of these Buddhist monks who just rose up into the air and entered the fire element? But somebody did something amazing. And that was Athens, 2nd, 3rd century BC. Buddhist monks were around in Europe a long time ago. Yeah? Immolating himself, yeah. Sometimes I used to think, oh, they're just fables. But, you know, when you sort of get into this meditation business, and you sort of get around, some of these things you thought were fables, actually they were true. So these days I think that's true. But you know, I'm being rational. Because you're basing on your experience. For you it's just belief. Yes? No, you don't. There's a good reason for that, because one of the things the Buddha actually made that clear, do not exhibit your psychic powers. And it's a clear reason for that, because you know, you'd just be regarded as a freak. If anyone did that, number one, they sort of try and disprove you. And number two, I mean, sort of, if you did that, it's mostly because people, you know, for your ego. So people who do have psychic powers, they keep them quiet. Don't ever think they don't exist. But you keep them quiet because... Oh, yeah, but that's right, yeah. Yeah, yeah, those are the kindred tricks. That's right, yeah. There's those sorts of things, where it's done as sort of a show, and usually you have to pay some money or you sort of it's an entertainment. But these other things aren't for entertainment. But anyway, Bonnie was first, yeah? Yeah, of course it would, yeah. They'll be reborn in a very warm country. They'll get reborn in a very warm country. I've got to move on a bit because there are lots of questions. One last question, then we move on to the next question. Well, it's there's only one psychic power the Buddha encouraged. Teaching the Dhamma. So it's true, he called that the greatest of the psychic powers, being able to teach Dhamma. So you've seen psychic powers. I've been teaching you Dhamma all week. Dear Ajahn, it is a tradition for great meditation teachers to continue well into old age. Mahabhur is nearly 90. I believe so. 60 is the new 40. You will be expected to continue into your hundreds. That's unfair. I follow my teacher. My teacher, Ajahn Chari, died in the 60s. Sorry, but Fish Chip Coochie Dream has to be abandoned. Why? Let's see what happens anyway. Aside from being an antidote to lust, what other purposes are there in doing a super meditation? It's basically to get rid of some attachments. But a super meditation, you've got to be very careful, because some people in the West just go really over the top with a super meditation. A super meditation is when you look at the body. They have all this shit inside, all this stinky stuff, you know, putrid, despicable, stinky. And sometimes you really get into that. Yeah, this body is stinky. Especially, I don't know if women get into this, but some, I've seen some monks really get into this. It's really weird. So instead of doing that, it's only if you just really have lots and lots of lust or lots of desire. If you really enjoy your food and you're eating far, far, far too much, you're pigging out every day, try this. That food on your plate, you put it in your mouth, you take some of that food and absorb it into your body, and the rest comes out as shit from the other end. Where did that shit come from? It must have been in the food in that plate. So next time you look at that plate, say, look, all the shit which comes out the bottom end of my body is actually in there on that plate. This contains shit plus all these other little bits and pieces which I absorb. But it's mostly shit. So tomorrow on your plate, or tomorrow morning, your breakfast, whether it's cereals or whether it's toast or banana, you have a look at there, and that's just shit in there, but it's just covered up with all this other minerals and stuff. So you have to eat shit, otherwise it won't come out the other end. It doesn't come from nowhere. So you look at that, and you lose your appetite. Pretty quickly. So that's one way of looking at it. So you just do this just so that it just balances you. If you're really over the top in lust and desires, then you balance it just with a little bit of a super. If you're really negative characteristic, which is most of you basically, then you have to do it with a bit of more metta and kindness. Oh, you deserve to have a rest. You deserve to have something to eat. Enjoy yourself. Have something, a bit of extra food. Because most people are actually very negative towards themselves and towards life. So we use it as a balance. Why don't the monks and nuns ask questions? It's obvious, because we're wise and peaceful. If they're shy, can you encourage them? They're missing out on an opportunity to clarify uncertainty by the practice. Oh, they know all about the practice already. These are wise beings sitting next to us. I'm curious about all those people who became enlightened. Just listen to the Buddha teach Dhamma. Do they bypass jhana or nip it in quickly before they become enlightened? Are they able to do this? Because you're just trying to get out of getting jhanas, aren't you? Everyone wants the easy way, the shortcut. But even those people in the suttas, people like Bahya, I use Bahya as an example because he just went to see the Buddha. And the Buddha listened to this, he got enlightened. It might do it for you. Okay? In the seen, there will just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the sense that smelt, tasted, or touched, there will just be the sensed. In the known, there will be just the known. Did it work? No. Why not? Because that guy had jhanas. This was just the straw which broke the camel's back, as they say. You put a straw on a camel, and it won't break its back. It was just all the other stuff which was on the camel, and just one last straw was all it needed to break the camel's back. So one last teaching, and that was just the final ingredient. Because Bahia, in his previous life, was one of several monks. Some of them became very famous. I think it was 5 monks, or it could have been 7, I forget now, who climbed up this mountain and then threw down the ladder so there was no way down, making that a determination, enlightenment or bust. I think one of them got enlightened. One became an anagami, the other one's busted. So only actually one got enlightened. But one who became an anagami. And so this Bahia, he got reborn. But he obviously, and that's where he came from. This was really sort of enlightenment or bust, really sort of dedicated to his practice. And would have often probably got jhanas up in that mountain before he died, but not sort of enlightened. So he was a lay person, and one day he got shipwrecked, and he became a little hermit. And because he was a hermit, this is like in India, you've been to India, you do anything weird or strange, you don't wear proper clothes, and people think you're enlightened. So he was wearing his bark, and people saw him just wearing his really weird clothes, and just because he was shipwrecked, that's all, say, wow, you know, you've come from the sea, you must be some sort of enlightened being. Because they thought he was enlightened, they started feeding him and giving him gifts. And he thought, this is much better than being a sailor. Just have to sit here and people feed me all day. You know, what a good life. So he lived like that for a while. And then he thought he was enlightened. And that's when his friend from a previous life as an anagami came down and said, you're not enlightened. You're not even close to being enlightened. He said, but if you really want to get enlightened, go and see a guy called the Buddha, not that far away. Not that far away, meant on the other side of India. And he made the journey in one night. Psychic powers. You know, he had jhanas and psychic powers. So that when the Buddha actually taught him, he had all the sort of, you know, the jhana and psychic powers. He just needed a bit of teaching. So that's how he became enlightened. So all those people who think, you know, they did it very easy, it doesn't actually say everything else which they did. So sometimes they're just in the suttas, a snapshot, the final moment which made them enlightened. So don't think there's an easy way. In fact, this is the easy way. That's really despairing, isn't it? This is the easy way. Please, can't there be an easier way, Ajahn Brahm? Can we get one of those jhana pills you talked about yesterday? Can an alcoholic be a meditator? I lead into a secret. There was an alcoholic who was a stream winner in the time of the Buddha. Sarakani. That was really weird. Because this Sarakani was an alcoholic. And when he died, people asked the Buddha, you know, he was actually quite faithful to you. What was he? So he was a stream winner. What? These days anyone can be a stream winner. The standards have gone really down. And he said, no, that guy was smart. So he could actually see the Dharma, but he still was an alcoholic. Now people actually ask about that. That's a very difficult thing to understand. Whether he just became a stream winner at the very, very end. Now after because when you're dead, you're dying, you sort of give up all of that. Or what was going on. But it just showed you just how possible it was. Even alcoholics could be stream winners. Now that's not an invitation for you to all go and take alcohol. But it just shows you just how it was possible for ordinary people in this world. Obviously if you want to be, once returning or non-returning, you've got to sort of give up all that stuff. But certainly you can be a meditator. Obviously, when you're meditating, you give up your alcohol. You keep your 5 precepts at least on a retreat. 8 precepts is much better. So, you know, you find out that as you're meditating, because when I started meditating, I used to drink alcohol. I wasn't an alcoholic, but sometimes got drunk. But for me, actually, what happens is you meditate, your mindfulness gets stronger. And you say, what am I doing this for? I never actually gave up alcohol because I was told to give up alcohol. It just didn't make sense to me anymore. So once you actually meditate, your mindfulness and awareness get so strong. You see, this is stupid. I'm just poisoning myself, wasting my money. That's why you give it up. So yeah, an alcoholic can meditate. But be careful, you won't be an alcoholic much longer if you meditate. Can you please talk a little bit about gratitude to one's parents? I find this difficult to do. Is there a sutra on this? I think there's lots of sutras on gratitude to parents. Because the Buddha said, the debt which you have to your parents is so great that even if you took both of them on your shoulders and they peed and shitted on you, because that's what happens when they sit on your shoulders. And you carry them like that for the rest of your life. You still haven't paid off your debt to your parents. That's what the Buddha said. And that was really sort of quite moving, because that's really hard to do. I couldn't do that. Could you do that? You know, you get shoulder ache, back ache, all sorts of other aches, and you're so busy doing other things. But it was a metaphor to say your parents sacrificed a lot for you, even if they weren't the best of parents, even if they abused you and mistreated you. They still did a lot for you. So we forget their faults, remember their kind qualities. You have gratitude for them. So you try to have as much gratitude as you possibly can. Now, my father's died a long time ago. But already, I think, was it the... That's right, the book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. That's right, the... That Opening the Door of Your Hearts, I dedicated all the royalties for that. All go to the Buddhist Society, but they go one day to build a hall for my father. So that's my dana for my dad. One day the Buddhist Society will have a new hall. And there's a lot of royalties come from that book. That's what I dedicated it for. So I did that because I got gratitude to my father. As for my mother, she's got Alzheimer's now. So she doesn't even know that she's got a son anymore. I remember being in UK and somebody telling me, because they knew my mother had Alzheimer's, and they said about this man whose mother also had Alzheimer's, and he went to visit his mother every day before going to work. So one day the doctor took him aside and said, "Why do you go visit your mother for? She doesn't even recognize you. She doesn't even know you visited this morning in the afternoon. Once a fortnight's enough." And he said, "The reason is, it's true, she doesn't know I've been. She doesn't know I'm her son. But I know she's my mother. That's why I go every day." I thought, wow, that guy really knows gratitude. You see, that's uplifting. That's beautiful. There's something, you know, you can really respect in that. So that's how we actually practice and cultivate gratitude. Please tell me more about the energy factor you mentioned this morning. Did the energy come automatically, or we need to cultivate it? And upekkha equanimity, we need a deep meditation to understand it. Thanks. Yes. Energy, cultivating it is a good word, just like you cultivate a tree by protecting it. So energy comes from stillness. Well, Ajahn Chah used to say what I've mentioned to you before, if you want to have a strong, fit, powerful body, exercise it. If you want to have a strong, powerful, fit mind, keep it still. It's the opposite way. Keep thinking, keep moving, and you wear out your brain. Keep it still and poised in meditation, and it's powerful and clear. So that's how you get powerful mind, and the energy comes from that stillness. Dear Ajahn Brahm, are you planning or thinking about another pilgrimage trip to India in the near future? Does anyone here want to go on another pilgrimage to the holy sites? Do you really want to go on to see the four holy sites? Who wants to go and see the four holy sites of India? What are those four holy sites? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. They're the four holy sites of Buddhism. Because that's where the Buddha lived. His body lived in Vulture's Peak, Jeta Grove, Bamboo Grove, born in Lumbini. But where the Buddha, where you find the Buddha. And this is actually the essence of the Chula Hatipadopama Sutta, the smaller simile of the elephant's footprint. The first simile which Arhat Mahinda taught in Sri Lanka. This is where you find the Buddha. You're literally standing in the footsteps of the Buddha when you get to jhana. And that's actually one of the things which I've really come out afterwards. I just been where the Buddha lived. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. So yes, I am leading a pilgrimage to the holy sites. It's called the 2010 Easter Meditation Retreat. We are visiting the four jhanas. Get on board. That's much more interesting than going on the holy sites of India. You can't afford it, and you're tiring, and it's dusty, and the food is tough, and you've got to go through the airport, you lose all your baggage usually. Someone always loses their suitcases. Dear Bhante, are the qualities and peace and patience you ask us to show towards the body and mind similar to upeka that you describe as an awakening factor? It's upeka becomes really intense peace and patience. It literally means just looking on, not interfering at all. Can you do that? Sometimes you just look on while somebody's washing the dishes. Say, that's not the way to wash the dishes. This is the way to do it. Someone is sweeping. That's not the way to sweep. This is the way it should be done. Sometimes somebody's driving you back. You're driving too fast. Don't go this way. I know a much better way to get to Perth. You're always interfering. So just, someone's driving you back, let them drive. Whichever the way they want to go is fine. Someone's sweeping, washing up, let them wash up. Who knows which is the best way? Instead of saying, I know the better way to do this. When you're watching your breath, why do you tell your breath, go in, go out? Don't do it this way, do it that way. Your body knows how to breathe. It's been doing it all its life. So just shut up and let the body do the breathing. You just watch it. Even meditating. If you get out of the way, your mind knows how to meditate. You've done it before, many lives. Just get out of the way and let it happen. That's called upeka. Getting out of the way and just watching. Not interfering at all. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Chah is known to have psychic ability. Why did he send you to Perth, where you were his first and only choice? He advised you to teach your way and to think he had something, vision, what you will do. Did Ajahn Chah ever told you that you'll be signing books and obliging devotees to post for the camera? Yeah, he always told me to practice my signature when I was there. No, of course not. No, Ajahn Chah had psychic powers, but no one, not even the Buddha, can predict the future. You know that story, I won't go through it because we're almost out of time already, you know, about reading the guy's palm because he wanted to tell his future. You know that story, he read his palm, and then after reading the palm, the guy said, Ajahn Chah, what's my future? You just read my palm, what's my future? He said, I never make mistakes. I know you never make mistakes, what's my future? This is going to be your future. Yes, I know, tell me what my future is going to be, sir. I've just read your palm. I know your future. Your future is uncertain. That's brilliant. That's typical Ajahn Chah. Sort of, you know, he winds you up and you think he's going one direction. And he tells this like joke, but it's deep, it's powerful. So you remember it. The future is uncertain. So no one knows what's going to happen or how things turn out, not even Ajahn Chah. So I just happen to be at the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time, whichever you have to look at it. And he said, because I made this resolution when I was a very young monk, I would never ask to go anywhere. I'd just be sent. So Ajahn Chah sent me here, and then he had his stroke and never spoke anymore, which is why I'm still here. No one sent me anywhere else yet. A question on right effort during meditation. Is it the persistent yet gentle effort performed by the meditator on to main awareness on the meditation object? Referring to your simile, being a passenger on the bus, is this the effort put forth to be aware of where the bus is going and enjoy the journey instead of falling asleep? Oh, sort of, but you can't drive the bus. So, yeah, sure, sometimes you think the bus is going too fast, it's going too slow, it's taken the wrong turn, it's gone in the wrong place. You just waste the time saying that. It's just like, you know, sometimes when I go on these journeys, the aircraft leaves late and I'm going to miss a talk. So, you know, what should I do? Should I go up to the pilots in the cabin, knock on the door and say, hey, can you step on the gas, please? I've got to talk today. Now, can you take shortcut? I'm sure there is a shortcut. Of course you can. I mean, once you're on the plane, that's it. You know, if it takes off late, takes off early, is it going to take that time? And it doesn't matter how much you complain, how much you will, please go fast, please go fast, please go fast. It just takes its time. So I like that simile because you're just stuffed. You're on the plane, whatever time it gets there, it gets there. That's some reason why I like going on plane journeys, because you really let go, nothing to do. Sit there and do nothing. So that's great because you can't do anything. So when you're a passenger, it's not persistent yet gentle effort. It's actually no effort whatsoever. Just sit back and enjoy not the in-flight service, but the insight service. Because that's what happens. on Buddha Air, which you've now embarked on. You sit down there, and after a few minutes, this happens on the aircraft. These flight attendants come up and say, "Madam, would you like first jhana today? That's on the menu as the hors d'oeuvres." I say, "Okay, yeah, I fancy some of that, okay." And then a few minutes later, the second course, second jhana, ma'am. Third or fourth jhana. And then someone comes up afterwards, a few hours later, they say, "Now we're serving stream mini." "Yeah, I'll take a lot of that, please." Followed by, once returning, non-returning, arahat. Special just for this month. Psychic powers, which one would you like? That's actually what it's like. These things come to you. You don't do anything. Can making aspiration actually will the consciousness towards it? Sort of, but aspiration. There are the four aspirations. Aspiration, when you want... No, it usually starts with inspiration. Inspiration, that's the first aspiration. Then you get aspiration, when you want something. Then you get desperation, when you just get so frustrated you can't get anything. Then you get expiration, when you give up. Those are the four aspirations. Inspiration, aspiration, desperation, and expiration. I tell me you got another aspiration for me some time ago. But anyway, aspiration, yeah, it works temporarily. But look, you know, just the best. Don't aspire for anything. Or if you aspire so, aspire for no aspirations. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. So don't aspire to do that. Because if you want to make peace, be kind, be gentle, you're not making peace. You understand the difference? I want to make peace. Shut up and just make peace. I want to be kind. I want to be kind. I want to be kind. I'm going to be kind. I really am going to be kind. I'm going to be totally kind. That's not being kind. Being gentle. I have to be gentle. I really have to be gentle. So you get really screwed up sometimes. What is your view on the 2012 whereby the polar shift will change the world map? What a world map. How's it going to change? Be really good. Does that mean that my monastery is now going to be up in the mountains, or it's going to be? Actually, I just would like it to be semi-tropical. So it just goes up a little bit to where Broome is. So maybe, like, you know, if you have enough aspirations, I can aspire when the polar shift happens. You know, Bodhinyana Monastery will just be like where Penang is now. So all you guys can come down to Bodhinyana Monastery, because it'll be just like what you used to. So, you know, you have a monastery, just like in Penang. I don't know what's going to happen. Of course it's. That's just a lot of old rubbish. Of course it's a lot of old rubbish. I guarantee I'll put my monastery up against your house. Bet. Then 2012 will be exactly where we are. Any takers? No one takes me on. What is your comment on sharing of merits with local deities and Dharma protectors? Should we practice this after every meditation? Yeah, but you've got to have lots of merits to share, first of all. Because you can't give away stuff when you haven't got it. So make sure you've got lots of merits, first of all. So really do your meditation well. Get into jhana, and then you've got some merits. You've got something to give. Otherwise, you know, the deities will come along. What are you giving me? Is that all? I came all this way from those realms, and that's all you're giving me. You haven't got enough merits. I'm going back. I'll never come back to you again. So get something worthy of giving them, first of all. I'm curious about all those people who become enlightened. I did that one already. Okay, let's put it in mind. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this is a good question. Can you turn the lights off, please? Go on. You have had encounters with a ghost. Oh, damn those exit lights. What about other beings such as devas and nagas? Do we all have our own guardian deva? Can we ask for our guardian deva to help us with our meditation? You really are getting desperate now. be an island unto yourself, said the Buddha. Yeah, there are such things as devas and Nagas. They're really busy. And it's just it's Easter time. They've been busy all week. So they need a rest. You've got a fat chance of a deva helping you. Okay, that's what am I doing? A quick question. Okay. During meditation, thank you. That's not much of a ghost question. During meditation, one nudge the mind to go with the flow and experience lightness and going into a vortex. Is that a flight of fantasy mind or the mind showing off? And when you have really interesting or weird experience in meditation, go for it, because meditation, 9-day retreats can be really boring. So get some weird stuff, vortexes or lights, see devas, see nagas or ghosts, and it makes the meditation interesting. At least, you know, you've got something to write home about afterwards. So if you see any devas or nagas come along, especially in your meditation, go for it. It's much better than a movie. So when you get really good meditation, if you even get some dreams, you get some really nice dreams. I remember a dream a long time ago, which I had after I'd been meditating, of having this great psychic battle with this Hindu. Flying through the air, zap, 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 me and a Hindu. And of course I won, because it was my dream. Take it as a good fun when you're doing some meditation, but especially, seriously, when you get sort of peaceful mind, you do get sort of what I call when perception gains its freedom or gains its wings. You get to the stage of meditation, the body's disappeared. It's like the real nimittas, but then the mind can actually make things. And it can make all these amazing scenarios. And most meditation teachers, I don't mess around with that, you're wasting time. I say, no, that's playtime. You work really hard, and you get all these amazing visions and stuff going on in your head. Enjoy it. It won't last for 5 or 10 minutes, and once you've had your playtime, okay, back to business, and get real limiters, and other simple ones. Because what's happening there, it shows you your mind is getting some power. Which is okay, enjoy it. It's fun, it's safe, but don't believe it, because it's all just fantasy, it's all just concocted stuff, not real. So if that happens, somebody was saying, reminded me, sometimes their body expands. Oh, like Ajahn Chah's body explodes, and there's a liver hanging off one branch of a tree, and his intestines off another one. That's just like the perceptions which come up. It can be really weird. Don't get frightened, because it's just perception just playing around. Because your perception is so trained, it's so brainwashed, you can only see in one particular way. I mentioned one of the first time. Sorry, I've got to finish these questions. No questions. One particular time, getting us a nice meditation over in Thailand, one of the first times this started to happen, passing by the washing line and saw this black towel on the line. It was jet black. And I just paused because I couldn't remember ever in my life, from a shop, seeing a black towel. Whites, pinks, browns, yellows, but not black. But this was perfectly black. And I just couldn't believe my eyes. And I just stared at it for about 2 or 3 minutes, a perfectly black towel. And then it changed into back to white again. And that's one of the first times I thought, gee, am I going crazy? And I realized it's not craziness, it's just what your mind does. What is white anyway? Just this perception which the mind has. And it doesn't need to be fixed. And this is what happens. Your perception is not fixed anymore. And you can see the walls just melt like chocolate on a hot day. You can see the floor starts to vibrate, become like a sea of waves. You're not going crazy, it's just the mind playing around. Your perception starts to get some freedom from you. When that happens, it's good fun. It's weird. I love weird stuff. And it doesn't do it any harm. You just enjoy it. Wow, this is really weird. And then after a while, you get back to your normal self. Perception's had its playtime and comes back to normal. So it's weird stuff, but I like it. Good fun. So, if you got into a vortex or whatever, brilliant. Enjoy. Dear Ajahn Brahm, last question, because it's almost 9:10. Why does Zen Buddhism use art forms such as calligraphy as a form of meditation? Does painting image of Buddhas encourage wholesome thoughts and can be considered a form of meditation, like the Zen practitioners? I think a lot of times if you do calligraphy, I've seen this calligraphy, and some of it you think, gee, I could do better than that. And they sell it in these auctions for thousands of dollars. You know why it costs so much? It's because of the reputation of the guy. Not actually the reputation, actually the quality of the calligraphy. It's just because a guy's supposed to be good at it. That's all I say anyway. But anyway, the idea is just do it without thinking about it. Especially not thinking whether it's good or bad. Brilliant or not brilliant. Just do it. So keep it simple. So if you can do calligraphy, just keep it simple. Just do it. And don't worry about it's beautiful or not beautiful. So that shows you have a clear mind. So you just, it's like in the forest monasteries in Thailand. You always say, just one of the old forest sayings, you can tell a person's meditation attainment by how they sweep the path. Just easy, just sweep it. Instead of, you know, it's like we Westerners would sweep it. We wouldn't know what we're doing. Sweeping, sweeping, sweeping. What are we doing? Because we're thinking about the higher Dharma, thinking about Four Noble Truths, and thinking about, I've got to be mindful, I've got to be mindful, I've got to be mindful. They just do it. Make it, keep it simple. So if you keep it simple, you can actually see just people are really relaxed, peaceful. And they can sweep the leaves just so efficiently. People who try too hard never sweep the leaves well. So this is actually how you find out. This is not just Zen Buddhism, it's just meditation in general. You become very efficient with what you do. So, there goes the questions for this evening. And this evening's entertainment as well. Always keep it a bit fun and lighter when you get to the last part of the evening, because you've all worked hard. Especially on the middle of the retreat, some of you are getting a bit frustrated. Oh, nothing's happening. 3-4 days, still not getting. And even the last retreat was much better, you know, the last retreat was much better. By this time I got much more. Ah, I'm going crazy, it's all going well, I'm getting frustrated. That's why you give a little bit of entertainment in the evening, to bring some happiness into your mind. Because when you have happiness and that encouragement, your meditation just flows beautifully. That's why I try and keep it happiness on the question time. A little bit of important answers, but a lot of fun and games as well. So now is the time to meditate or go to bed. And if you have a go to bed tonight, see if you can have a dream of doing a psychic battle with Ajahn Wayama. Have fun. But please don't hurt her. So have a nice evening. Take care and good night.
Sadhu.
Very good. Okay, much better.